Welcome to Financial Planning for Oil and Gas Professionals, hosted by certified financial planners Justin Brownlee and Jared Machen of Brownlee Wealth Management, the only podcast dedicated to those of you in the oil and gas profession to help you optimize investments, lower future taxes, and grow your wealth. Learn more and subscribe today at BrownleeWealthManagement.com.
Welcome back to another episode of FPOG, Financial Planning for Oil and Gas Professionals. This week on the podcast, we've got Nathan back with us, a partner with our firm, and we want to discuss something that Nathan has admittedly much more experience than I have. And the topic we want to discuss today is different career tracks within oil and gas and the short-term and long-term financial planning implications that are associated with those career tracks. And I'll give kind of a summary of the career tracks we want to overview. But Nathan, welcome back. We are excited to chat today.
Yeah, absolutely. I have been away for a little while working in the business, but excited to have the conversation today.
That's right. So to lay the groundwork, Nathan and I were talking through this topic. And I made a post on LinkedIn about this the other day, this idea that there's kind of different tracks to wealth. And if you look at social media, it's easy to, if you're on Instagram, or I'm not even on TikTok, but I'm guessing it's there too. There's kind of this glorification of being a founder, being an entrepreneur, owning your own business, taking some path that is more of an independent maverick path, owning your own business. And there's this thought that that is the way that you achieve serious big wealth. I totally agree with that. But my post on LinkedIn really argued against it in the sense of it is vehemently not the easiest path to serious wealth. So I adamantly believe the easiest path, if you are someone today that, you know, is 55 years old and you have $4 million, the easiest path today to get there is just work for a large company, probably a major, super major, and stay employed for 35 years. Use their benefits, contribute to the retirement plans, make sure you're getting full 401k match, pension, maybe some equity compensation as well. And if you just stay alive and stay employed, you have a very good chance. So Nathan, I would say that's kind of an income of $200,000 to $300,000 a year is what you're growing to. And then you're there for decades. And I vehemently believe that is the easiest path to getting to, say, age 55 with $4 million. I also believe the easiest path to $10 million or $20 million is to be at a large publicly traded company and just move up the company. And so that was the post on LinkedIn. And so this made us want to dive in. What are the different career tracks? What are the planning implications with each one? Nathan, do you want to give kind of a quick overview of the three potential career tracks that we want to talk about today?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you hit the nail on the head. There's a variety of different paths that one can take in this journey to wealth. And so the first one that we've identified, you had already mentioned it, just working for a traditional big company and really prioritizing longevity in that company, working for a number of decades, accumulating wealth year by year. And eventually, we are strong believers that you'll get there. And so the second path that we have identified, Justin already alluded to, is maybe you've worked your way up in that said big company and you are now making a bit higher income and you have a bit more upside within that company. And there's a very attractive path to wealth given the upside in that that big company in the role. And then the third path would be a less traditional path, but you may start your own business. Maybe you're a founder. Maybe you are an early shareholder within a private venture, and a tremendous amount of upside in that path. Also, a tremendous amount of risk as well. And so, we'll talk through each of those different paths and things that you may want to consider in a variety of categories.
Perfect. And if you've listened to our podcast extensively, you may already know this. I have never been in oil and gas. So I am a, you know, really a financial planner from day one, and that's my background. The way that I found this niche was I was a lead advisor at a really large brokerage firm in North Houston. And the product of that position is 90% of the clients that I served were at super majors, or they had private oil and gas companies. And so that made me go to my wife with this idea that I'm pretty sure that I could just quit and start a blog, which freaked her out. So I just thought, hey, I can just blog about tax planning and estate planning ideas that are only relevant to you if you own a privately held oil and gas business, or if you're at a certain level in, you know, ExxonMobil, Shell, BP, Chevron, insert 10 other companies here. And so that's my background. But I wanted to have Nathan on this podcast because he was in oil and gas. You were in oil and gas, Nathan, for about a decade. And so you have very tangible experience with, I would say, number one and number two. Even though I'm not in the industry, I have enormous experience with number three. So quitting the safe job, taking an enormous amount of risk, selling my house, amongst other things, to get a business started. And so with that introduction, I think we can kind of dive in. So again, we're going to talk about kind of a traditional super major path, a little bit more of a spicy path within large companies, number two, and then number three, having a material stake in a private business. Maybe it's one you found, or maybe it's one you just work at and you have a reasonably well-sized position in the company. So with those three tracks, let's dive into number one. And so Nathan, what's kind of the first thing you think about when you think about number one, the traditional path of spending 35, 40 years at a pretty large oil and gas company?
With the first path, the traditional oil and gas company, like you mentioned, I spent about 10 years at Koch Industries, just working my way through the organization, serving in a variety of roles. And the real big priority in my mind with a path like this is longevity. And with that longevity, you are really prioritizing your savings rate. And so with the longevity that you will spend at a company like that, your priority is just accumulating wealth year by year in the best way that you possibly can. And so you're meeting living expenses, you're really just making sure that you're saving as much as you can, and the accumulation over decades will really surprise some. And you know, it's really easy to get impatient. And you know, you mentioned earlier some of the sexier forms of wealth building that you might see on social media. I think with a traditional big company path, you are probably at risk of getting sucked into a variety of side hustles. I know I did that a number of times, just getting excited about, you know, maybe I could expedite this process with, you know, real estate over here, or, you know, a side business over there. And really, when I take a step back, the most effective thing I could do was just make sure that I'm really tending to my budget, saving year after year, and just be patient. And it's incredibly difficult to do sometimes, but it's incredibly effective over the long term.
I would agree with that. The thoughts that come to mind that describe path number one is secure, reliable. And it really is a little bit more of a known outcome. Now, if I really dive into the financial planning implications, I think if you're on this track, it's important to understand the game you're in and really maximize the rules of the game. And Nathan, I think everything in path number one comes down to one, maybe you could say this is two things, but one thing. And that one thing is savings rate. As long as you have command and control over a really exceptional savings rate, I mean, you are almost guaranteed to get to your mid-50s or 60 with, I mean, today I would say it's more than $5 million. And, you know, if you have two spouses that do this, I mentioned this in the LinkedIn post, you can absolutely get close to an eight-figure net worth. And so we have a lot of clients that spent a career in oil and gas, and you know, Nathan, you know this, but the way that we describe them is often white collar people that think that they're blue collar. And I mean that in such an admirable way, as such a compliment. There's a humility there. And it kind of makes sense because you're talking about a family that, you know, 25 years ago, they probably bought a house that was $100,000 in a Houston suburb. And yes, that house is worth a lot more today, but a ton of our clients in that segment never sold that first house as they continued to make more money. And they reached retirement age with a really extraordinary amount of assets, significantly more than the vast majority of Americans. But they live a very humble, disciplined life. They don't overspend. They spend substantially less than their assets would allow them to spend. And so I think that's kind of a hallmark. That's a trait of people in number one. If you want to crush it in that first career track, have command over your savings rate. If you are saving 15% of your income and your employer is putting 15% in, whether it's 401k or pension, you are functionally guaranteed to have mega freedom really before you even hit 60. But everything revolves around that one thing. What is your savings rate? And then after, you know, number two is arguably make sure you're diversified into mostly stocks, not bonds and cash. But everything revolves around that one idea. What is your savings rate? Are you saving 4% of your income or 15% of your income? Nathan, what else would you add to that?
I think one thing that stood out in your comment there is just the word discipline. And if I could boil number one into anything, it would be discipline. And that ties in savings rate, spending, obviously very important with this path, and longevity and sticking with it for a number of decades and just being patient. It just boils down to discipline to me. That's kind of the path there. Another thing that sticks out to me with this path is really how you incorporate your external life into this type of path. And one of the ideas that we were talking about with each of these paths is life planning. And so with a traditional big company, the hours and the structure with which you work is fairly defined, and they're more of your standard work days. Obviously, there will be opportunities for you to work maybe long nights, maybe a weekend here or there. But for the most part, we would expect that people on this path are a little less strained in terms of their time. And so life flexibility, I think, is a little bit more common in this path than maybe options one or two, or options two or three.
I think that's a great point. Another thought with savings rate, you know, it's great that I'm able to sit here and tell you that that's the number one thing. But I forgot to mention, Dave Ramsey talks about this a lot. And I believe all of Dave Ramsey's research that he cites is from the book, The Millionaire Next Door, which in the 1990s, that was by far the most extensive study that had ever been done on who is the prototypical American millionaire. And if you're familiar with the book, strongly recommend it. Kind of the secret at the end of the book and all throughout the book is that the typical American millionaire is a very humble person who doesn't spend very much money. And you would never be able to tell by the car that they drive or the house that they live in that they're a millionaire. So that was kind of the end result. But that research found that the single greatest indicator of whether or not someone would become a multimillionaire was their savings rate. It wasn't their income. It wasn't their level of education. It wasn't, and this is kind of crazy to me, it wasn't even their portfolio allocation. So the single greatest trait that decided whether someone would become a multimillionaire was, simply put, it was their savings rate. How much of their income did they put into long-term investments? Anything else we need to hash out here, or can we move on to career track number two?
No, I think we've exhausted the first path. Let's move on to number two.
Okay. My description for number two, this is a career track that is, you're probably still at a large company. So you might still be working at a super major, but you're kind of doing something a little bit more, you know, extreme to hopefully get from, let's say, a $200,000 to $300,000 income into a 500,000, 600,000, and up to seven figures and beyond. And I kind of think there's three paths. I'd love to get your feedback on this, Nathan. One is get a top MBA. So attend, complete a really terrific MBA program. And number two would be spend decades overseas. And so find a way to get into those assignments, find a way to keep those assignments, and be content to raise your family in lots of different countries. And so extensive overseas assignments would be number two. Number three is one that you're very familiar with. Get into a little bit more of the trading. And so, you know, in oil and gas, if you are a natural gas trader, your ceiling for income is just way higher than, you know, let's say a reservoir engineer at most super majors. Both are excellent career tracks. And like we've said, both can be, you know, multi-millionaires if you play it right. But I think those are the three paths to find yourself at age 35 or 40, making, you know, let's say 800,000 a year instead of 300,000 a year. But Nathan, anything I'm missing or what should we kind of add to that?
Yeah, I would say you hit the nail on the head, whether it's overseas assignments or whether it's just relocating within the States. I know that was my path and one that I am very fortunate and thankful that I took, a little bit reluctant at first, but one of my mentors at the time mentioned that, hey, this is going to be an incredible opportunity for you. So whether it's relocating geographies or just relocating different roles, I would argue that the more exposure you can get to different parts of the business will really just give you a better command of how that business adds value, who you might be interacting with in a future role, and really set you up to take on leadership opportunities at a higher level in the company. And so you mentioned that path, and then also maybe some of the higher upside paths, whether it be trading, business development opportunities. Those are very lucrative, can come with a bit more risk, but there's definite upside, some asymmetric risk that comes with roles like that. And so I think you've hit the nail on the head, just summarizing some of those paths to number two.
Perfect. And, you know, financial planning implications wise, in career path number one, I said that everything about your financial future revolves around your savings rate. With number two, I am going to also kind of make an emphatic, you know, exaggerated statement. Nathan, I think most of number two's financial planning, you know, mindset should be centered around longevity. What I mean by that is it is great to have a really substantial income, but, you know, a really substantial income is so much more powerful if it's there for 35 years compared to, you know, 15 years. And so, you know, a lot of this thought exercise is, do I want the end result of my career after 30, 35 years? Do I want to have, you know, 5 million in liquid assets, or do I want to reach 10 or 20 million in liquid assets? And I think it's great if you can achieve a top 1% income. And I mean, you know, you were there, you lived that life. So it's really helpful to have a top 1% income, but there is a huge difference between having a top 1% income for 4 years and then burning out compared to being able to have staying power and doing it for decades. What are your thoughts on longevity, and how do you kind of find a sweet spot there?
Yeah, I think it's such an important point. And so you highlighted longevity being at the forefront of path number two. I would argue that it may be a balance between longevity and savings rate in this option. And what do I mean by that? So if you really love the path that you're on and you can see yourself in this role for a number of years, even decades, then great. I think longevity is the play here, and continue to work in this role and knock it out of the park, earn that high income. But if you do find yourself getting burnt out, or maybe you aren't as satisfied with this role and you could find yourself in a happier role, maybe outside the company, outside the industry, maybe in path number three that we'll get to here shortly, savings rate is going to be a big deal. And so if you want to take a bit more risk, maybe in a private venture, if you want to retire early, savings rate is going to be a big deal as well, because that's going to allow you to accumulate massive brokerage assets that can ultimately help you bridge to retirement if you were to retire early, understanding that you can't necessarily, in all cases, access your retirement accounts until 59 and a half. And so savings rate to me is also a pretty big important principle with path number two.
That makes a lot of sense. Do you remember what was your highest savings rate as a percentage, not raw dollars, but do you remember kind of percentage of income wise, what was your highest savings rate?
I can't recall because it fluctuated from year to year. But I mean, there were definitely good years where it was upwards of 50% or more, just because I knew that I wanted to take a bit of a different path, and I was preparing for that pivot. And I knew that in order to give myself the best chance of success, I kind of had to accumulate acorns, so to speak. And so I was preparing for the winter, accumulating those acorns, maybe increasing that savings rate those years leading up to my pivot. And I'm really fortunate I did, because it really set me up for success. So yeah, it's definitely something that can be valuable if anybody is looking to do that.
That makes a lot of sense. I feel like a lot of this comes down to life planning too. So asking the question, what is my ideal future life? 50% savings rate is I mean, it's honestly crazy. It's unique. No one's willing to do that. But Nathan, I think that highlights that, you know, there's a lot of outcomes in career track number two that you might achieve a top 1% income, but you might be in that role thinking, I can only do this for 5 years. I cannot do this for 25 years. I will not do this for 25 years. And if that's you, doing things that are a little bit extreme, but set you up for success are required. And so, you know, tangible things that come to my mind are building up an enormous brokerage account, non-retirement assets, significantly more flexible and easy than retirement assets. Number two, buy a house that is less than 1x your annual income. That's extreme. A tiny minority of Americans are able to pull this off. But if you are in career track number two with a really extraordinary income, but you don't want to do it for the next 25 years, you know, the single easiest solution here is control your biggest expense in life. So if you're able to buy a house for less than 1x your annual income, which, you know, you were able to do, that sets you up for optionality. It introduces flexibility. It introduces really the ability to do and take whatever different track you want to take. If you're sitting there and you have, you know, a really substantial 7-figure mortgage, well, your fate is a little bit decided. If you didn't like that job, you better start to like it. Because you might be a little bit stuck if you don't do it. What else would we add here?
I think we've touched on quite a bit. I think, are you ready to move on to number three?
I think last thing I would say is when you're in career track two, you're making incredible money and you're accumulating wealth pretty quickly. There is a lot of desire. I would say there's just way more desire and interest in alternative assets when you're in career track number two. I don't think that's a bad thing at all. I think it's a good thing. We like alternative assets. We have a fixed fee structure to be able to better evaluate, serve, and incorporate into your portfolio and financial plan, private equity, private credit, private real estate, and things of that nature. But I would, if you're in that track, you need to get $5 million in a boring portfolio before you go barking up that tree. You are not approaching financial freedom until you have $5 million in a boring portfolio if you're on the path to 10 to 20 million. And so don't try to go into, you know, sexy investments too quickly. And you can also listen to our podcast that I think Jared and I did recently on why we think private equity is probably going to have a really brutal next couple of years, potentially. So yeah, should we move on to number three, Nathan?
Yeah, that sounds great.
Okay, so You know, I think I said at the beginning, numbers one and two are way easier ways to build wealth. And so if you're looking for the easiest way to reach $5 million, go work for a super major. Keep your job for 35 years. Avoid major mistakes. If you're looking for 10 to 20 million, I would again say that the easiest path is moving up the ladder at a large publicly traded company. But here's the thing. If your goal is to have $40 or $50 million, you're probably not pulling that off at Chevron. That's probably not happening. Or you could have a totally different goal. And that goal might be, hey, I do want to have, you know, some material wealth, but what I'm really excited about is I want total control over my entire day. I don't want to have to work at Chevron's campus. I don't want to have to go into, you know, ExxonMobil's used to be Springwoods Village, and I'm forgetting the current name for some reason. And so it could either be you want really significant wealth, you're passionate about building something on your own, or it could just be that you want control of your time and day. But let's dive into this career track. You know, you're an owner or a material partner in a more privately held company. Nathan, what should we point out in this career track?
Yeah, I think you already alluded to it a little bit, but just the range of outcomes is just incredibly high. And so you think about the level of risk that you're taking in a role like this. Speaking from my own experience, I had pivoted away from an industry and role that I had been kind of working my way up to for a number of years, and taking a role in a completely different profession. And so I had to prepare myself for the range of outcomes that might follow with a completely different shift. And so there's a lot of downside if you fail, if the business doesn't take off, but there's a tremendous path to wealth if you find success, if you're able to, you know, stick through some of those early years building and growing the business, and then you kind of push through and get to some pretty asymmetrical outcomes if you can ultimately get it to a point where you have some momentum and you're building some enterprise value and you're able to take money out of the company in the form of distributions. There's just a tremendous amount of upside that you don't necessarily get in paths one and two, where you're ultimately working for another company. But you have the opportunity to have a significant ownership stake, and in preparation for this this discussion, Justin and I were really speaking about how 1 hour of work as an owner of a business is tremendously more valuable than 1 hour of work in path one or two in terms of the wealth that you're able to generate from that 1 hour of work. So I think there's a tremendous range of outcomes, and it's just something that is probably at the forefront of path number three.
Great point. Nathan, I made the comment to you when we were, you know, planning out this episode. I think I made the comment, I feel like I am on the brink of actually experiencing a lot of the time freedom that goes along with owning a business. So, you know, the dream of quitting, and like I mentioned, this career track number three is the one that I can probably speak on a lot more than number one and number two, because I never worked for ExxonMobil or any oil and gas company, but I did have a very reliable, safe, secure job that was probably going to pay $200,000 to $300,000 a year forever. And it had a 17% 401k match. So I had the epitome of this, you know, job that, okay, I can provide for my family and really have a great career and enjoy it. But I wanted total freedom. I wanted to do things my way. And I wanted to have this, you know, unique fee structure that, you know, most investment firms just don't have any interest in. So that kind of meant I had to start my own firm. But Nathan, I told you before that I feel like I'm just now starting to get to that level of freedom where I've got a lot more control over my day. And I'm finally seeing the fruits of, hey, I don't have to go to that office that I had to go to every day in my prior job. And you quickly made the comment, well, hold on though. I mean, you work almost every Saturday, you travel a ton, and those are downsides. And it's funny because I don't even think of them as downsides. But that point's also true that, you know, if I'm spending an hour on Saturday in the business, well, there's a drastically larger potential payoff for me doing that than me spending an hour on Saturday in my previous job. And so it's just a drastically higher leverage situation with a way higher ceiling. But it's also, you know, it's easy to kind of look at things with rose-colored glasses and forget some of the sacrifices. I mean, we're in year 5 now. And years 1 through 3 are really fun to talk about now. But they were pretty, there's some parts of them were pretty hard.
Absolutely. And I think in that discussion, a few things that I would highlight, it probably feels really good, the level of life flexibility you have right now, relative to years 1 through 5. And you spoke about years 1 through 3 being pretty stressful, pretty, it's a grind for sure. And so to look at where you are now, you are light years different than you were in years 1 through 5 or 1 through 3. But I think another really important point with this third path is this is such an intentional path that one takes that it's very unique to have such a passion and for what you are doing. And I know you work on Saturdays, you travel a ton, but to wake up every day and really get excited about what you're doing and feel like you are right where you need to be. Not only do you have a really big fire in your belly for what you're doing, but there's also a pretty big economic upside for you. So there's a lot of incentives for you to maybe take more of that risk. And it truly is risk. We're speaking a lot about, you know, the upsides of path number 3, but there's a significant amount of risk if things go sideways. And so there's ups and downs back to those range of outcomes. If it works, it really works great, and you can find yourself in a really successful place. But you have to be willing to accept that those risks that it might take much longer than you would expect. And so I think there's back to the range of outcomes and the risks that you have to take. It's just immense.
And I think, you know, the big thought there is when you're thinking about doing something that is more risky and away from the traditional path, you better have a reasonable chance at getting compensated for it. And so back to the financial planning implications, when you're thinking about long-term wealth accumulation, that needs to be the question. There must be. And, you know, Nathan, you hit the nail on the head. I do think at some point it could be fun to have my wife on the podcast.
That would be a great experience.
Yeah, I mean, I think it could be pretty interesting to talk about some of those early, you know, couple of years where it's like, we sold our house and I go to my wife and I come up with this idea of, you know, babe, let's sell the house and let's take all of the money from it and just put it in the business. And it's fun today, you know, it all worked out. And it ended up being a great investment. But it was an absurd thing at the time. Our kids are heading into elementary school. None of our friends are doing this. Hey, I love the Woodlands. The Woodlands is a corporate place. There are very few entrepreneurs in the Woodlands. I felt like an alien doing some of the things I was doing. No one in our church, no one in our social circle was doing anything like this. And so, yeah, that could be a fun podcast to have Lauren on here and give some of her perspective. But yeah, I think there's got to be, you know, two thoughts there. One is, what is the potential payoff if things go well? And so it darn near better be higher than number one, because you are taking way more risk and really taking kind of a crazy path, potentially. And then number two, I think it is good to ask, hey, what's the potential really high payoff? But I my favorite question is not, what if things go really well? My favorite question is, what if things go average? So something that really helped me think about quitting my prior job and starting this business was, I think the tweet was from Brent Bashore. And I don't even know if I'm going to be able to find the tweet. If I can, I'll try to link it in the notes. I have no idea if I can even find this. But basically, Brent said this, and Brent runs a private equity firm in Missouri, so middle America. Really interesting follow. But he had this thought that was, understand the idea of a base rate. And everyone in life always assumes that they're going to be a top 1% performer, a top 1% achiever. Instead, ask yourself the question, what if I'm perfectly average? So what if I'm not top 1%? What if I'm just average? Now, only play games where that average base rate is still really, really compelling. And so if I go do this and I'm only average, am I still going to make significantly more money than my previous position? If the answer is yes, well, that's an opportunity worth pursuing. If the answer is no, if the answer is, well, you really need to be a top 3 or 4% achiever to beat what you're currently doing, that may not be a risk worth taking. And so take a risk where if it just kind of works out, you're still very much ahead. Nathan, I would go so far as to say that, so the financial planning implication of number three, I would, and you probably disagree with this, which you should, I would probably say the one financial planning implication, if you take the owner entrepreneur route in any way, your savings rate matters way less. Your savings rate doesn't matter even close to what will the equity that you own be worth in 10, 20, 30 years? Because if you have the opportunity for a really, you know, substantial future payday, future liquidation event, I mean, that completely dwarfs any 35-year savings rate. So it's kind of interesting to go to path number three and say, I mean, it is almost the opposite. It's not that savings rate doesn't matter. You shouldn't ignore it. And you should be making sound personal decisions as well as running your business. But the equation totally changes. Your future financial well-being is all about the entity that you're operating, and maybe you own it or maybe you're a partial owner. It's all about what is that entity worth in the future. It's not about how much are you putting in the S&P 500 this month.
I think it's a great point, and I don't disagree with it. I would maybe add to it a little bit. I think it ties in with the time horizon that you're operating on. I don't think your savings rate necessarily is as important as you're building your business, right? Within those first 5, 10 years, maybe even more than that, you should be focusing on growing that business, and you should be working on building the cash flow and income of that business to a point where ultimately you will be able to take money out and you will be able to diversify and save at some point in your life in a really, really significant way. But I feel like that doesn't need to be the star of the show for a number of years. I think ultimately you will get there in an asymmetric way where it far surpasses anything you could do by saving a little bit every single year for decades.
Nathan, I think that's a pretty perfect way to say it. Kind of a timely discussion. I think the time that this episode comes out, I think it's going to be right after my interview with retired founder. And as he mentioned in the podcast, he had liquidation events that totaled about $90 or $100 million. And so you play that out, you think about his financial plan. It is important for him to have personal, you know, goals and personal discipline in his finances. Because when he's in the middle of building his business, he doesn't know that it's going to end with a $90 million liquidation event, right? But when you look back and when you think about his career arc, when you think about his financial planning implications of his life, well, you know, it is good if he can have a big savings rate and accumulate $8-9 million in a brokerage portfolio. That is terrific, and that should be a goal, and it should be obtained. But that is a tiny fraction of what really mattered, which was pick the right game, pick the right industry, pick the right niche, build that business, grow your entity's value. And so kind of surprising that at the end of this podcast, the financial planning implications within each career track are kind of wildly different from one another.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's important to highlight exactly what you said at the beginning. These are all viable paths. I know some of these may sound sexier than others, but all of them are perfectly viable. And it just is a matter of where you find yourself. What is your skill set? What lights you up every single day? And which path do you want to take? So I would just reiterate that it's really none of these are bad paths. There's just different considerations to each of them.
That is such a good point, and so critical to ask, you know, what is your ideal life? It's easy to say, well, here's number one, here's number two, here's number three, and you make a list, and the bigger numbers at number two, number three look way sexier. But here's the thing. You can have an enormous amount of wealth in number one if you play the game right and you map out your savings rate. Here's the other thing about number one. You don't have to sell your house. You can play golf in the first couple of years. I didn't do much of that, you know, in the first 2 or 3 years, right? And so there really is an element where a lot of this comes back to life planning and asking that question, what life do I want? Because all three of these career tracks can end up with more money than you know what to do with if you plan it right. And so coming back to what's a meaningful life and what are you really wanting to achieve over the coming decades? Anything we need to add, or is that a good place to stop, Nathan?
I think that's great. I love kind of tying it all together at the end, knowing that we're speaking about paths to wealth. And it is not only financial wealth. There is also wealth in your time and your freedom and ultimately what life you choose to live. So I think that's a perfect place to end it.
Awesome. If you have ideas for future episodes, shoot us a note, give us an email. But until next time, we will talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the podcast. You can subscribe or connect with us at brownleewealthmanagement.com or send ideas for future episodes to podcast@brownleewealthmanagement.com. Thanks, and we'll see you next time. This podcast is for informational purposes only. Nothing discussed during this show or episode should be viewed as investment, legal, and tax advice. If you have questions pertaining to your specific situation, please consult the appropriate qualified professional.